Session number 11748, Reel 13.
Colonel Ismail Khan, Reel 13.
So, they asked the chap standing at the rear to kick the people in the front. Since I was the officer, I was standing in front. So 8 people are kicking me. And the men refused to kick. So I shouted, "Now you've done it, for God's sake, kick me and let's get out of here." So reluctantly, the men behind me, 8 men standing in one line, kicked into the thin air. And one chap was quietly tapping me on my rear end. So the Jap said, "No, it's not true. Turn around." And they told me to kick all 8 of them. So I stood there. I said, "I told you to kick me. Now I'm going to kick you." So I started kicking them, really smart kicks to 8 chaps, walking up and down. It was amusing in its way, but still it was done. And then we turned back and came to camp. Most of my men had lost their shirts. The Japs had torn them off their bodies. So it all, we arrived back at the camp, very crestfallen lot. One day, I was in a truck. Our Indian drivers were driving, and not for my battalion. And the Jap was sitting next to him. Suddenly the truck coughed and choked and stopped. It stopped. So the Jap came down and they opened the bonnet and we were told to get out of the trucks. We sat on the both side of the road. And the Jap was looking at this, the carburetor is gone. The Jap decided to go back and bring another truck. So he jumped in another truck, went to bring another truck, and these men opened the carburetor. A Chinaman was standing, gave him another carburetor. He put that carburetor into the truck, and the carburetor which he had made to fail were given to the Jap, to the Chinese, and the Chinese gave him money. I heard later that the Chinese paid about $600, state dollars, for that carburetor. Like this, the pilferage was going on. We needed money for our sick and badly fed people who needed extra feeding, who were suffering from avitaminosis. Beriberi was common. So we decided in my battalion that the men, out of their earnings, could pay something. As I said before, our camp's total pay was $25,000. And the sales in our canteen were $90,000. Where the extra money came from? Came from pilferage and selling and buying stuff with the Chinese. The men in my battalion were very generous. I, with the Subedar Major Feroz Khan, a very nice man, Honorary Captain Feroz Khan, great soldier. He was captured in Kota Lamara in the First World War. We said that if they give money, we will give them IOUs. And the battalion will make good the money to them individually as they paid when we get back to India. But our men, amazingly enough, they said no. What they'll give, it'll be towards the battalion fund and they don't want any money in return. I don't remember the exact amounts we collected in our in our welfare fund, but we collected enough money to buy extra food. Like the dollar I mentioned before, we had $300 a pound then, and it would be cheaper to begin with. And eggs and things like that we used to buy and give it to the people who were weak, and especially those who were in hospital. So one Viceroy commissioned officer and 5 men who were mostly NCOs would go sick. Our doctors would declare them sick in the camp. We used to walk 10, 15 miles to our hospital where our men were admitted, go there and live with them for a week and buy them extra food and leave it. Then every 2 weeks, monthly, we used to get these parties going. And I often went with the parties to fall sick, go to the hospital. Falling sick was meant then walk 10 miles, 12 miles, 15 miles to our hospital. I forget the exact mileage now. And like this, we kept our men going. So much so that in my battalion, we had 35 people who died of malnutrition and disease. throughout her 3.5 years of captivity. Everybody asked me when we came back, how is it that we lost only 35 men? I said, we kept them supplied with food and extra food and money. And this is what we did. When we came back to India, I discovered that many other battalions had lost many, many more people of nutrition and things like that. Others were helping too, no doubt. But Indian Army personnel, who remained as prisoners of war, had suffered less casualties from disease than the British did. British lost a hell of a lot. That was due to this factor I told you, honestly, this is the only thing I can think of. We would have been lax in our discipline. We allowed our men to steal, sell, and make money. And while the British, they did it up to a point. Australians did it. There are books written, the story was
King Rat.
King Rat. They were a bit this thing, but such similar things were going on. And in the King Rat, even you will notice, I saw the film here, and I read the book before I came to England 6 years ago, that in the King Rat, I was disgusted. When I read about 50, 60 pages, I gave it up. It seemed a bit unreal to me. But such similar circumstances, I mean, incidents were very common. That's how the Indians lost a fewer men than the British. The biggest casualty of the British were on the Thailand Railway, Siam Railway.
Did you think the Japanese could win?
Not well. Some intelligent people, as I told you, like Dalgalkar and these people just sit down and work out. And we thought the turn of the tide had taken place in 1942, November, October, after the Al-Alamein push by Montgomery and the Battle of Midway in June 42. But most of us, even I, could swear to you today that I had never thought that the British could make such a tremendous quick comeback. But, I mean, the vague hope was there. We did not get the news so fully. We never heard anything, positive that was going on. And who could think of Battle of Midway being the thing? Today I can think Battle of Midway was a great thing, because they knocked out most of the Japanese ships, seeing the movie here now. But then it didn't register. Just as the loss of Prince of Wales and Repulse didn't register in my mind. Why are they worried about two ships? The whole war depended on the safety of the two ships. But two ships battered the fall of Malaya.
Now, I interrupted you with you being about to go on to the Iron Air trials.
Yes. You see, when I got back home in about November 45, I got a message to go to the Red Fort, to report to the Red Fort, Camp Commandant there. So when I arrived there in Delhi, it was in Delhi, I arrived there and I was said that two people have cited me as defense witness. One was this Major Aziz from the Bawalpur State Forces. He said that when I went to see him, he was sitting there very crestfallen chair. I said, why are you citing me a defense witness? I'm a hostile witness. He said, no. He said, did I remember that when I was taken to the separation camp in July 1942, that he treated me well? I said, no, he didn't. And then he cited an occasion before this concentration camp business, that we had gone to listen to Mohan Singh's lecture. We were delayed. So our camp, where we were working in Tenga Air Base, the other side of Singapore towards the Straits, was closed. So four or five of us were stay the night in this Indian National Army camp. And two doctors who knew me took me there to a barrack. And there was this Bawalpur State Forces, a Sikh officer called Thakur Singh, And Major Aziz, senior, he was the senior most officer in the Balfour State Forces there. Commanding officer of the Balfour State Forces. No, commanding officer was Colonel Gilani. He was a very some man, he was operating. And Thakur Singh, the Sikh, who was very convivial, he brought a bottle of this Chinese whiskey. And I got very, 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 high on that. And I completely got in a blackout. But I was steady, standing, talking. But I don't remember. There, I believe, and there was Captain Ayyappa from the Indian Signals, Ayyappa, whom we called ACI, A-Y-Y-A-P-A, Ayyappa. He was from Kurg, where General Timaya and General Karyapa came from. Very fine lot of people. Karyapa didn't know a word of Urdu or Hindi. He was born and brought up in English public schools. He knew no Urdu at all, and as I said, we used to call him Englishman Browned Off. So, he was there too. And I made some very rude remarks about Mohan Singh. Very, very rude. Ayyappa was kicking me in the shins under the table to keep me quiet. But I wouldn't. Later on, these two South Indian doctors, forget their names completely now, they took me to their bunk for the night. They gave me a camp cot with a mosquito net to sleep in. As I got in, fully dressed in my shirt and trousers, got in the bed, I found the whole world going around. And I got horribly sick. So it took me the whole night to wash the sheets and whatever they had given me to sleep on, and wash my shirt and trousers, have a shower, and sat there very crestfallen the whole night, shivering in damp. And next morning, they gave us transport, we went back to our camp. This instance, this Major Aziz repeated in front of a British major who was taking the summary of evidence in his case, and I as a witness. He said, did I remember that I got very drunk that night and I was abusing Mohan Singh? And if he had reported me, what would have happened to me? I said, why didn't he report me? For the simple reason that he would have been there. I would have said that he's inside, he's basically anti-INA, that's why he was entertaining me. Why was he entertaining me so much that I should get so drunk to become abusive or something like that? I don't remember. I didn't remember. I said, if you bring me this into it, I'll bring your thing into it, that you kept us hungry and thirsty for 4 days in the separation camp, in the Alkaaf Gardens opposite your Bidadari camp. So I said, I shall be hostile. So the British officer looked at him and said, did he still want me as a defendant? He said, no. So I got up and left. Then another chap, a Pathan officer from the Valley of Swat, Captain Akram. He was on 514 Punjab Regiment. He was one of the Indian National Army Gestapo's, practically. He was a Pathan officer, one of the few Ujjaini Aine. Their men didn't join the IRA. So he also cited me as a defense witness. I said, what did he want me to be a defense witness? He said, since I was in the habit of abusing the IRA and abusing Mohan Singh and working among the troops for them to turn against the Indian National Army, and if he had reported me, I would have been in trouble. I said, who gave me four solitary confinements? There were chaps like him. So I got myself out of that too. When I came back, we went out, this British officer was a major. He invited me to go to the mess for a drink with him. So I said, he said that one thing he could not understand, that Muslim troops en bloc did not join the Japanese, except a few spots here and there. While Muslim officers like Zaman Khani and Shah Nawaz and most of them Punjabi officers had joined the Japanese. While all the Hindu troops had joined the Japanese en bloc, the Sikhs and Hindu tribes, how is it that some Hindu officers like Bhani Badwa, Dargalkar, Bahadur Singh, Ayapa did not join? So I said, I've been thinking about it all through my time as a 3.5 years as a prisoner of war. I said, the simple reason is some centrist officers like Bhonsle, Narendra Singh Gill, Nagar, Parkash Chand, for 5 Baluj, later he joined the service corps, and like this, they joined. But again, some centrist officers like Popeye Gansham Singh, from old 16 Light Cavalry, though 16 Cavalry didn't go to Malaya, but he was in the Rice Corps, Supply Service Corps. He had joined the Service Corps. And Dargalkar and Hari Badwar did not join the Japanese. The reason was, for the Punjabi officers, that they came from a very strong military background, but from NCO and Viceroy Commissioned Officer class. Viceroy Commissioned Officers were raised from the NCOs. They had some education, like matriculation and maybe intermediate in colleges. But their upbringing was a little different. They were not, as we call them, westernized or anglicized. Some of them had been to the Prince of Wales Royal Military Cadet College in Dehradun. But basically their mentality was the same. They had joined the Japanese immediately, without, you know, they'd made some of their reasons that they joined. But those officers who had the Western education, in the way, under the Western, you know, values, they were most reluctant to go over to the Japanese. Now, those Hindu officers who joined the Japanese, like Naimon Singh, the Supreme Commander, was an ex-ranker. Gurbakhsh Singh, ex-ranker. I can count you innumerable, number of officers who were ex-rankers from NCO class. They joined the Japanese. And they really subverted their men too. The joining the Japanese at that time was, you know, the acronym which I read in one of the books about when the Russians used to recruit people for their KGB services and that. Foreigners, for example. I read a digest, a long story, a book condensed. The acronym was MICE. M-I-C-E. M stood for money. I stood for ideology. M stood for money. I for ideology. C for compromise, and E for ego. It was a story of a KGB chap, I forgot his name, Cherenko, his name was, that he recruited a Japanese writer, a pseudo-intellectual, to work for the KGB. And they offered him money first to run his newspaper. Then he exploited his ideological thing for Japan, to join communism and things like that. Compromise, after giving him money, he took a couple of receipts from him, compromised him. And then having done all this, then he raised his ego. He's intellectual. He's a light of the free Japan. And he's a harbinger of the great Japanese age. Like this, you see, MICE. Now, I can put MICE right back to many years back in Malaya. First is money. Money meant security for them. Getting paid, living comfortably, becoming officers again, becoming soldiers again. I was ideology, freedom of India. It gave them that ideology. Then compromise. Once they got the INA, got changed their ranks and put on different ranks, you know, and called them captain majors and things like that. But the But the ranks were, say, were different, like gold bars and blue bars and things like that. So that was their compromise. Once they compromised, then they were easy meat. Then ego. While we were wasting away in prisoner war camps, living from hand to mouth on meager rations, working, getting beaten up by Japanese day and night. Now, beating up by the Japanese was one of the things which used to terrify people. Terrify people. For example, officers were living in perpetual fear of being beaten up. So in a young officer, Pathan officer called Sanaula, from service corps, one day him and I decided that let's go out to the camp, for the working party, let's get beaten up, so that we should get over the fear of being beaten up. When we went out, he put on dark glasses, which was an anathema to Japanese, like a red-backed quibble. And he put a nice little white towel around his neck, and we dressed up, and I had my dark glasses, turned my moustaches up, we went out. No matter what I did that day, the whole day, to get beaten by Japs, nobody beat me up. But Sanaula, for a slight thing, got beaten up. He was beaten up into a pulp. When we finished the day, he began to blame me for not getting beaten up. I said, look, I did everything in the book to get beaten up. The fellow would beat me up. So, that was the first fear to get away. Indian soldiers and Viceroy Commission officers and Indian officers, somehow they've got inherent fear of being beaten up. Unlike a public school boy in England who learned to box, played rugger. You see what I mean? They're on my own personal observations. I may be wrong. Now, they didn't mind it, the personal bruises and things like that. Kids in schools fight. They beat each other up. They get bruised. They get punished. But in India, in our class of people, it was considered a disgrace to get into a fight. If we got into a fight in school as young kids, we came home, we came for a lot of punishment at home. It's a disgrace to start a fight. You see what I mean? So even to this day, people of the subcontinent, and especially the subcontinent, they're afraid of physical violence. When they get involved into it, then they go for it. But they would avoid it. So physical violence of the Japanese was considered a big threat to everybody. And then the concentration camp of the Indian National Army, there was a sweeper called Nimu. He used to administer some tremendous flogging to the men who did not join the Japanese. There were a lot of stories which I would personally like to avoid. But these were the things. And that's one of the reasons comfortable life was an ideal of everybody, of the people of subcontinent. Those of us who joined the army, I mean, you can analyze the situations, my own feelings. For example, the first thing that entered your mind was to live like the British officers. You know, mess kits, glamour, uniform, good living, mess life. Even rich or poor, one idea was to do that, reach that goal. Having attained that goal, you don't want to live, but you don't want to lose it, you see? And your perceptions change. Then if the war came with it, it was into the bargain. You got to go and fight. Your training then in the Indian Army was such that you were ready to fight, go into battle. You were psyched for it. So you went into battle fearlessly. But once that damn battle was over, then to come back again and go into something much worse than a concentration camp and Japanese prisoner of war, that prisoner of war being marched to Manchuria and things like that, was too much to stomach. I'm trying to analyze it to the best of my ability. But the psychological part of it is this, that some of us, majority of us, who did not go in for it, was really because of certain moral strength and principles which guided people like me who could stand up and face the music. That moral fiber. I mean, physical bravery can take you up to a point. Then it peters out. But moral courage will take you much further than physical courage. Moral courage in the end comes to the test, and I think we people who stood out of the Indian National Army and did not join it because of moral values, I think, and moral courage. That's what saved us. Though when you are faced to look into a barrel of the gun, now, I forgot to tell you this story, for example, in the same vein. There was a Muslim officer from Hyderabad State Forces in Rajputana Rifles, I think he was. A Rajput battalion, I forget now what. He was captured in Hong Kong. A Subedar Major, forget his name now, Hakim Khan, joined the Japanese. The men were being subverted. He refused to join the Japanese. And Japanese said, we'll punish him. Finally, he was beheaded publicly in Hong Kong. His name was Captain Ansari. He was an uncle, he was the uncle of the wife of the Chief of Staff of the Pakistan Army today. Today was the Chief of Staff as Aslam Beg. Captain Ansari was his wife's uncle. Captain Ansari was beheaded with a sword publicly in Hong Kong. At the end of the war, he was given a George Cross, posthumous George Cross. Then there was a captain called Mathur and Jairam, two chairs from the service corps, Indian young officers, junior than me. And they were taken to Thailand with working parties. And they both decided to escape in two different routes. Jairam was recaptured and brought back to our concentration camp, where we were in July 42. While Nargol, this is a chap called Mathur, was beheaded by the Japanese. But nobody saw him, but he was executed. Because Japanese said anybody who was caught escaping will be executed. And Mathur was executed. Much later on, during the Kashmir War, in 1949, after the ceasefire in Baltistan area, I met the same Mathur's younger brother, who was an officer in the 8th Gurkhas, 2nd 8th Gurkhas or 3rd 8th Gurkhas, I forget now. And he met me after the ceasefire in my place where we were negotiating. And he was his brother Mathur. And he confirmed that Mathur was not heard of after his attempt to escape. He was captured. So the Japanese did execute people there. While two officers, a chap called Pritham Singh, former of the Punjab regiments who were in Singapore, Pritham Singh, and the other chap was Parab, P-R-A-B-H, Parab, P-A-R-A-B-P. He was a cadet with me. He was a regular officer. But he was a little senior than me. He was with the 419 Hyderabad Regiment. Pritham Singh and Parab was a Marhatta. They both joined the Indian National Army with the idea to escape. And they did escape over Burma into India. But they did not join the fighting INA. They joined and then they scooted. Nobody knew where they were. They were hunting for them. Finally, they found their way back to India, and they were both given military crosses for escaping from India. They made a very daring escape from Singapore all the way up the...